Hey, it's Brian Curtis from The Ringer, and I want to tell you about the Press Box podcast. The Press Box is a podcast for anybody who likes news, whether it's about sports or politics or pop culture, and wants to understand how that news really gets made. We have new shows every Monday and Thursday. We have long interviews with everyone from John Krakauer to Joe Buck. Your social media feeds are bursting with information every day. Let us help you sort it out. Join us on the Press Box.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. April showers bring a loaded sports calendar, and FanDuel is the place to bet on it all. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and get paid instantly when you win. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett, recording on a Sunday afternoon after I just wrapped up watching the Red Sox game. Looked like it was going to be an easy win for the Red Sox as they were up 5-3 in the ninth inning, but Kenley Jansen decided to give us a heart attack, like he ordinarily likes to do. I don't know what it is, but he refuses to throw strikes at some points. The Red Sox did come out of this one 5-4 winners, and after the horrendous four-game losing streak where the defense was atrocious, nice to see the Red Sox get a win here, but man, Jansen, this is now another concern for this team. He has faced 26 batters and he's walked 8 of them. And that doesn't include the guys he hits and the wild pitches, right? You look at that number, it's over 30%. He's walking north of 30% of the batters he faces. No reliever was over 22% last year. So anyway, did not have fun watching Jansen. Didn't have fun watching the Red Sox for the most part today. But we have a busy week ahead. Michael Pina is going to join us early on this week. We'll get you ready for the playoffs, of course. The Celtics are not going to know their opponent until Friday night because you got to wait for the whole play-in situation, of course. Philly plays Miami, and then you have the 9-10 games between Atlanta and Chicago. So we're not going to know until Friday who the Celtics are going to be playing, but we'll get into potential matchups with Pina, who we'd want, who we wouldn't want, because it's a crazy final day in the NBA season. So we'll get into that with Pina early on this week. We'll also get a Bees playoff preview for you this week as well, as they try to bounce back after the early exit last year, of course. And they picked up that win on Saturday over the Penguins. Actually, a very interesting game. And in all likelihood, it's a 91% chance that they're going to end up playing the Lightning. They're going to win the Atlantic. Like I said, 91% chance. So there is a chance that they don't get the number one seed in the Atlantic, but odds are they end up playing the Lightning in the first round. A Lightning team, by the way, we think of the Lightning, the back-to-back Stanley Cup champs, are just not the same team. Now, Kucherov has been awesome. Still just 2 assists away from 100 assists, has a real argument for the Hart Trophy. I mean, there's some other guys that, of course, MacKinnon out in Colorado, there's other guys that have arguments, but Kucherov has one as well. And Vasilevsky hasn't been the same. He's 29th this year in goals, 27th in goals against, 33rd in save percentage. He's given up 11 goals in his last three games. So this could be a good matchup for the Bruins in the first round, especially the way that the Bees have been playing lately. They've been really playing well down the stretch. So we'll get into the Bruins as we get closer to the postseason, find out who they're going to be playing against. And we'll get some more draft stuff later on in the week too, because we're now, 11 days away from finding out who the Patriots are going to take with that number 3 overall selection. Okay, but before we do that, I wanted to get out my Sunday thoughts today. So let's start with this one. The Red Sox continue to be a flat-out PR disaster, PR nightmare. Sean McAdam wrote today for MassLive about Larry Lucchino's funeral. Red Sox principal owner John Henry and chairman Tom Warner, both of who were in town and on the field for the home opener only 48 hours earlier, were not there. Henry was reportedly feeling ill while Warner was apparently in England. Okay, so as Sean McAdam pointed out in his article, Lucchino was a partner for the Red Sox for 13 years, and he served as the team's president and CEO for three World Series championship teams. And he was responsible, Jamie and I talked about this after Larry Lucchino passed away, that he was in charge of the renovations at Fenway Park. He did a ton for the Red Sox organization. So obviously there were issues between them, right? Totally, everybody understands that. But you don't go to the funeral. So first of all, it's just, on the surface, it's just horrible that they didn't go to the funeral, that they didn't attend. That's the first thing. That's almost the obvious point that you have to make, right? Where you cannot defend that. Secondly, this is just where the ownership group, they truly don't understand PR at all anymore. How did they not think that this would be a story, right? A partner that helped build a championship culture, a man that did a ton for the organization, and the current ownership group doesn't attend the funeral. This doesn't compare to other things, but think about all the missteps for this organization, because this group now has become unlikable for multiple reasons, and they've botched multiple things over the past 5 years or so. And this is just another thing, and worse than most of these other situations, right? I mean, we're talking about not going to a guy that worked for the organization for 13 years, not going to his funeral. It's just, you cannot defend that. And I just think about all this stuff that has happened with this ownership group. It's always something. They can't escape for like 2 months without a controversy. It's unbelievable to me how much they misread situations. And the fact that you didn't go is just terrible to begin with. But just think about all the stuff with this organization. I'm not connecting one thing to another. I'm just pointing out all the things that have happened over the past 4 or 5 years or so with this group. Okay, so the best player in baseball is now playing for a different organization, and his prime years are with another team. They're not with the Red Sox. Mookie Betts' prime years are with the Dodgers. And I'm not getting into the whole conversation about did Mookie want to be here, did Mookie not want to be here, but the fact that Mookie Betts is not here and the ownership group, they didn't end up getting a deal done. But even if Mookie didn't want to be here, that's partially on the ownership group. Even if you want to make the argument Mookie was never going to sign here, well, that's partially on the ownership group, okay? All right. Then they lowballed Xander Bogaerts, okay? And look, even if you say, hey, that deal was horrible in San Diego, I would tend to agree with you. But I'm talking about, think about the PR of this. Right before the season begins, you sign Trevor Story. You offer Xander Bogaerts one extra year on his contract at $30 million. So if you did the rest of Xander Bogaerts' contract, that extension, if he had opted in and gets the extra year, he'd be making less money on an annual basis than Trevor Story. So you just basically slapped him in the face. Xander Bogaerts was talking to the media, trying to like hold back tears, talking about how he wanted to be with the Red Sox. So that was how you started the 2022 season, with the guy that was the perceived leader of the team, and not perceived, he was the leader of the team, pissed off at the ownership group, pissed off at the organization. Okay, before this season, the full throttle comments, where Tom Warner says, we're full throttle, we're all in, okay? And then he tries to walk back the comments, which he couldn't really justify walking back, but he tried to. I mean, he came up with all these ideas of what full throttle means to him. Remember, he talked about it, this is how he lives his life? It's just a bunch of bullshit, right? So then what happens after that? The Red Sox barely do anything in free agency. And then what do they say? They say, oh, Sam Kennedy tells us, yeah, actually, we're going to be spending a lot less money. Essentially, to paraphrase what he said, how, yeah, we're not going to be spending up to the CBT, which is fine if you think that's the route to go. But this is after Tom Warner said full throttle, right? It's just time after time, this is what they do, right? Where it's just another example that this group, they don't get it anymore. They really don't. They have no idea what the fan base wants, or they just don't want to give the fan base what they want. And they have completely lost reality with the fan base. They have no understanding of what's going on anymore. And maybe part of that was ever since Larry Lucchino was not part of the organization. Maybe you can trace it to that point. But whatever the reason is, right, whatever the reason is that this has gone so far in the opposite direction, it's very difficult to do. When you win four World Series, it's very difficult to do to just completely lose the fan base, but they completely deserve it with the way that they've handled things over the past 5 years. And not going to Larry Lucchino's funeral, I couldn't believe it. I honestly, I shouldn't even say that, because when you saw it, I guess most of you are like, oh yeah, that adds up. But to me, I'm like, they didn't go to the funeral. I mean, unbelievable. All right. Next up on the list, Rafael Devers. I'm just starting to wonder if durability is now going to start to become an issue for his career. The Red Sox just played their 16th game. They took 2 of 3 from the Angels. Nice. I do admit that was a nice bounce back for the club, especially after Friday night, which was another embarrassment for the Red Sox. But Rafael Devers just missed his 4th straight game and his 6th of the season. Now, Alex Cora said he expects Rafi to play on Monday morning. Marathon Monday expects him to play. But the shoulder thing has already cost Rafi what? I mean, simple math, 37% of the early part of the season. So it's early. I totally understand all that. But that's sort of the point, isn't it? If he's already had to take 6 games off already this season, isn't this going to be a trend that continues where the shoulder is just going to keep barking throughout the season? If he isn't better now, isn't it just going to keep happening? Because he got the 2 days off earlier in the season. Now he's got 4 days off. What's going to happen next time? Is it going to be 8 days? Is he going to be on the IL? It just seems like right now the shoulder thing is going to be a situation that he's dealing with all season long. And remember, this is the first year of a 10-year contract that just kicked in this season. Last year was not the extension. This year, the extension starts. So you have 9 years left on this thing after this season. And when you give out this type of contract, you need the first few years to at least be elite, right? I mean, everybody talks about the back end is going to be bad. So we heard about Mookie. Oh, yeah, wait till that back end when he's 38, 39. Well, this is Rafi's first year on the contract, right? And I'm not saying that he's not going to have a great season. And you know I love Rafi. But I just thought about this because I just wonder if it's going to be lingering all season long. And I gave you some of the issues the other day in terms of why I thought, hey, maybe the shoulder's a real issue. He wasn't hitting the ball in the air at all. And he's hitting 184, the hard hit rate down 17.6%. So he's not making good contact. So I just wonder, and I truly worry, are those numbers, how much better are they going to get this season? Because clearly when Rafi's right, he's a guy that's going to be in the top 10 in hard hit percentage. He's going to be in the top 10 in runs batted in. He's going to be in the top 10 in doubles. He's going to be in the top 10 in home runs. Like, that's who he is. He's one of the best sluggers in the game when he's out there and he's healthy. But is he going to be healthy this season? So I think it's a massive concern, especially when we're talking about a guy that's year one of $27.5 million, right? I love Rafi, but I don't know how anybody wouldn't be worried about the contract going forward now, because the defense to begin the season has obviously been a massive issue for the team and Rafael Devers. Actually, I'll give David Hamilton credit, made a great play at short today, but the defense has been an issue for the majority of the season. But I just look at Rafael Devers and I just wonder how he's going to age, and already year one of the contract, we're dealing with an injury. And I get it, it's not like a soft tissue injury, it's a shoulder thing, but let's see how this thing goes on throughout the season. Okay, obviously Sunday was Mike Gorman's final game. Now, he will call the first round of the playoffs, but in terms of the regular season, by the way, the Celtics did win, if you were wondering. Pritchard had 38 points. 38 and 12. He was awesome. And it's crazy. He played north of 40 minutes of this game. Like, Pritchard's a guy that's going to get real burn in the postseason. You see him out there against other teams' reserves. He's so much better than those guys. But it was crazy just seeing him the past couple of games where he's getting all these minutes just go absolutely nuts. But it was awesome in the Garden. They gave Gorman a standing O when they had that video. He was crying, obviously. He's crying throughout the day, holding back tears, etc. But I'll say this, as someone that grew up listening to Mike and Tommy, of course, it became part of your life, right? Where they were just so into the team. And obviously, Heinsohn played for the team, coached the team, like, he had that background, but Gorman was all in too. And you felt especially that way when they got Ray and KG, right? Because after they had, now remember, some of Gorman's great calls come earlier than that, but Pierce in the early 2000s, like, he was trying to drag that team to conference finals, and he did 1 year. But then it got dry for a little bit there, right? Where the team really went south, and they ended up in a situation where 2007, I was thinking, I don't know what's going to happen with this team after they missed out on the first two. And obviously, the first two picks is what I'm talking about. They don't get Oden, they don't get Durant, and they swing the deal. Eventually, first they get Ray, and then they, of course, get Kevin Garnett. So I thought that even rejuvenated Tommy and Gorman to a different level, because, like, okay, we have a chance to win a championship again. And you just think about some of the moments, right, where the Pacers playoff game, where Gorman's calling it, and this is the game famously. Paul Pierce, they showed video of him on the broadcast today talking about it, where Pierce is staring down Al Harrington, Al Harrington's talking shit to him. They're going back and forth. And Gorman's so into it, he says, Joe DeRozan, who was the official, tells him to shut up. And then he says, Pierce buries it right in Harrington's face. And it was just an awesome moment, right? He has his catchphrases, takes it, makes it, or got it, right? And I know the crowd today all say got it at one point. But that duo for so many years, like obviously Gorman was awesome individually. Heinsohn was awesome individually. But I just like talking about them as a duo because that's how I grew up watching these guys, right? It really did feel like two of your uncles or something talking about basketball. And I'm not saying that as an indictment. I'm saying that as an awesome thing. It just felt like you were watching the game with them. It almost felt like that, right? They were your home broadcasters, and they were certainly biased because they wanted the team to win, but that's sort of how you want it in terms of your home broadcast. We're not talking about a nationally broadcast game. We're talking about your home station, and most of them are that way, right? And Tommy, remember, Tommy was so great where he would just go nuts with the calls. Remember, he went nuts in that Phoenix Suns game where O'Brien got tossed and Stoudemire had fouled Pierce. And Tommy said, Paul Pierce is an upper echelon player in this league, and he's been treated like a rookie. He just goes nuts. He's going on a rant for like literally 2 minutes. And then there was obviously one of my favorite parts ever in terms of the Tommy-Mike relationship, the on-air relationship, is when Tommy says, he's talking about Aaron Baines, and he says, I just saw Aaron Baines in the locker room. He looks like all of Australia. He is really put together. And then you see Gorman is just kind of like, they show the camera view of them, and Gorman is just kind of smirking as Heinsohn's like hitting him in the arm. So we've just been blessed as Boston sports fans to have those two guys. And of course, Scal the past couple of years taking over for the late, great Tommy Heinsohn. But man, that was just so much fun having those guys together for so long. And I wish Drew Carter and that group the best going forward. But That was something, man. The Celtics did a really good job with that, with the halftime ceremony as well. So just wanted to mention Tommy Heinsohn, and of course, Mike Gorman, the final day for him today. But as I'm listening to Mike Gorman call the game today, it just brought me back to thinking about Gorman and Heinsohn. And that's not taking a shot at Scal or anything along those lines. It's just my whole life I had Heinsohn and Gorman calling games together. So I was just reminded of those moments, especially the ones where Heinsohn just went nuts. Okay. My next Sunday thought is winning this year is just so important for the Celtics. And you say, oh yeah, Brian, that's obvious. Thanks, man. Thanks a lot. But listen for a second here, okay? If you look at this Eastern Conference, the Bucks are banged up. And by the way, I know they've stunk against Indiana, but they may have done themselves a favor today by losing, because now they're the 3 seed and they get Indiana. And the Knicks are the 2 seed after the Knicks had to go into overtime to beat Chicago. But I believe that Philly's going to win that play-in game against Miami, and the Knicks are going to get rewarded with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey. And in the first round, I know Halliburton's a great player, but he hasn't been the same since the injury. I actually think this works out better for the Bucks than it does the Knicks for them being the 3 seed. There was some real stuff going down the final day of the regular season. Like, the Cavs just tanked their game so they could get Orlando in the 4-5 matchup. I really hope, because I'm not worried about either one of those teams. I'll get into that in a second here. And we'll do more of that with Pina, but my point is, I would like Orlando to win just because the Cavaliers are like, yeah, we want you guys. We're going to tank for you guys. Like, they should be tanking for teams. They freaking stunk for like the past couple months, and they're the ones saying, oh yeah, we'll take care of them easily. But anyway, I look at this Eastern Conference, not to digress, but the Giannis situation, the Bucks are banged up. Middleton is not the same guy. The Knicks, as I've said, I believe they're the biggest threat to the Celtics. But that isn't like a typical second best team in the conference, right? Where if you think about it, you look at the Celtics, even if you go back to the 08 championship team, let's do that. So the 08 year when they won it, the Pistons were a legit threat, right? We talked about that all season long because remember, the Pistons had just won a championship in 04 and they had been to the conference finals every year since. And in 05, they were actually one win away from winning another championship. They lost to Tim Duncan and the Spurs that season. So that was like a legit bona fide threat. It wasn't going to be like, hey, if they lost to the Pistons, it would have sucked as Celtics fans, but I don't think people across the NBA would have been like, that's a massive upset, right? It would have been like, oh, they lost to a team that has already won a championship, right? And then you go to 2010, when the Celtics went to the NBA Finals. LeBron was reaching his prime at that point. That Cavaliers team had won 61 games. The Celtics were older at that particular point in time, especially considering Garnett in 09 didn't play in the postseason because of the injury. They weren't the same team. I believe they were the four seed that year. So that was like, okay, there's some real competition here. If you get it now, LeBron obviously ended up quitting and then the whole decision thing happened. But the point is just like that was LeBron was the best player in the league. And the Pistons have been together forever. And you look at this Knicks team, and this isn't me trying to criticize them. It's just they don't have the credibility that those other teams had, right? The Pistons have won a championship. LeBron had won MVPs, and he had taken that Cavaliers team to an NBA Finals before with a significantly worse team. So those are like teams that had a resume. The Bucks would be the one team that has a resume just because Middleton's a champion, Brooke Lopez is a champion, Giannis is a two-time MVP and a champion, but I just don't buy into them right now, mainly because of the health of Giannis, but also the fact that Lillard hasn't been the same guy this year. He hasn't been the same consistent, great scorer, and as I alluded to earlier, Middleton doesn't look like the same guy. The 76ers, let's see what happens with them as it pertains to their health situation going forward. Let's see what they look like in the postseason. That is like a legit threat, but the thing about the 76ers is the Celtics have sort of owned that group, right? When we're talking about the Embiid-led Sixers in the playoffs, last postseason, Embiid's down to 23.7 points compared to 33.1 points in the regular season. His field goal percentage, 43% of the postseason compared to 49.9. I know you can say he's banged up, but that's sort of the thing with Embiid. He's always dealing with injuries, right? So he has not been an elite playoff player. He's been one of the best regular season players for the past 5 years. He has not been an elite playoff player. The Magic are not ready and they can't shoot. The Pacers can't defend. The Heat, we've told you, they have not gotten it together. So the point is, I just can't remember, and I'm thinking about recent Boston sports history, I can't remember an easier path than what we've seen with this Celtics team to get to the finals. Like, I think about the 18 Red Sox, their path was very difficult. They had to play the Yankees. They had to play the Astros that had won the World Series the year prior. So that was like a tough group to go through to get to the Dodgers in the World Series. And I think about the 18 Patriots, you can say, yeah, the Chargers, they were frauds, sure. But then you had to go into Arrowhead and beat Pat Mahomes and the Chiefs. The closest thing I can remember recently is the 16 Patriots, where they get the Houston Texans in the first round, who you knew they were going to beat. And then you got that dumb Pittsburgh team. Now, Pittsburgh on paper was loaded. But remember Antonio Brown, where Mike Tomlin saying, don't give them any material. And Antonio Brown is Facebook Living Mike Tomlin giving the team the post-game speech. And there was like rumors that Antonio Brown was mad at one point that they gave Le'Veon Bell the ball to get a touchdown rather than throw it to him. But that team was a mess, right? And they showed Brady the same defense for 15 years. He just destroyed the Steelers every time they played him. So that was like the closest I can remember to an easy path where if you looked at the 16 playoffs, because at that point, the Ravens weren't really good. Like most of these years, the Ravens were a threat, but from like 16 to 20 where the rate or 16 to 18 rather where the Ravens weren't good, you kind of knew that the Patriots, like the paths were easier for them to get to the Super Bowl. That's kind of what I feel like is like that's the closest thing that we've had recently to the Celtics situation where the road is just soft. And look, we don't know what will happen with Philly. I acknowledge that. Like, and you think about into the future as well. This is why I say this year, based on I just went through the field. You think about the future though. Philly, what if things go really south in Clipperland? Do they go after a guy like Paul George? I mean, he would be a perfect fit with that group when we're talking about Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid. The Magic, as much as I say I'm not a believer now, they could upgrade their shooting. They could try to make a swing in a trade. And if it's not this year, maybe the year after that. The Knicks, I mean, they're in New York. They could eventually do something. And it's not like they're out a lot of draft picks or anything along those lines. So those teams could do stuff in the future. So it's not a coincidence that the Celtics ran away with the East. They're much better than how these teams currently are. But in the future, those other teams could catch up. So I just feel like now is the time. And I've defended Tatum saying he's ahead of schedule. And I stick by that comment. He was ahead of schedule. The fact that the Celtics, this core, and when I mean core, I'm just saying Tatum and Brown, the fact that they've already made the finals, they're ahead of schedule. Like this doesn't ordinarily happen. But I will say this, having this combination of the East being so down and this roster being so loaded, and Tatum and Jaylen will probably never play on a better team, especially considering the health this year, right? Like they're going to have the same group together next year, but the health may not be the same. In fact, it's likely not to be the same. It's likely that Porzingis or Drew, one of the two, will miss more time, right? So having this combination of everything sort of working in your favor, it just feels like this is where the runway is officially starting where, hey, time's ticking, man. You got to get this thing done. Because, and I think about it too, just from a fan's perspective, we've been waiting for this for a while. By the time Sunday comes, next Sunday, I should say, we are going to be so fired up because we have not watched interesting basketball in a couple of weeks here because credit to the Celtics. Like, they did this. Like, they got such a big lead that they could just mess around for the end of the season. But the pressure, the burden of the pressure on this group because of what they've accomplished in the past by making it to the NBA Finals, making it consistently to the Conference Finals, because of all that, because of what they've accomplished, and because of what they did this year, all that stuff, the pressure is going to ramp up. And it's going to be considered a failure if they don't finish this thing off. And if they don't, think about what happens next year. Think about how that pressure intensifies even more next year, where you start to hear the whispers, is this the right group, blah, blah, blah. And I do think that Tatum, he has the chance to enter the elite of the elite category this year, right? Because right now, fair or unfair, I believe when people look at this team, they don't put Tatum in the same class as the Jokic's, the Giannis's, quite frankly, even the Lucas. And I know Tatum's team has made it further in the playoffs, but I don't think people think Tatum is on the same level as Luka. And I know Tatum's been first-team All-NBA, but some people are not going to vote him first-team NBA All-NBA this year. Like, there's a chance Brunson finishes fifth in the MVP, and now that it's positionless as it pertains to the All-NBA ballots, there's a chance that Brunson gets that nod over Jason Tatum. But people nationally also, if you ask them, hey, would you take Jason Tatum or Jimmy Butler in a postseason series, there's going to be a lot of people that say, you know what, actually, I would take Jimmy Butler over Jason Tatum because of some of Butler's recent playoff performances, right? But the thing is, if Tatum gets a championship, there's no more questioning him. He becomes a made man at that point because there's nothing really else you can say. And the thing right now is, with this team, they've made their big moves, right? They brought in Porzingis. They brought in Drew. They sent away Rob, Marcus, and Brogdon. Like, even you, if you go back to when they lost the NBA championship to the Warriors in 2022, you could say, okay, these guys are young, as I acknowledged. And they could make more moves. There's no bigger move coming now. This is the core group. And if Tatum doesn't win a championship with this roster, it's going to be a massive issue, right? So if they don't, say, get into a situation where they come out on top, it's going to be very difficult to defend this Celtics group based on the talent they have, based on what they've assembled, and based on what the conference looks like right now. And the team that they've surrounded Tatum with, great shooting with guys like Drew Holiday, great defenders like Drew Holiday, a guy that can score in the post like Kristaps Porzingis against mismatches, a great sidekick in Jaylen Brown, a guy that's exceptionally good at making plays in Derek White and his elite defender. So right now, when you have this type of group, I just can't think of a team and a front office and an ownership group that has put their star player in a better position to win a championship than what the Celtics have done with Jason Tatum. Like, the past 4 to 5 years, nobody has done a better job surrounding their star with talent. Take, for example, the Mavericks, right? It looks good right now that they got to Kyrie. They tanked at the end of last season to get Lively in the draft. They traded for Gafford. But all that is like the third version of the team that Luka's on. The Celtics have done a great job sustaining success with this current group and adding to this group. So the pressure is certainly on Jason Tatum, as we are now a week away from the NBA playoffs getting underway. Okay, my next Sunday thought, Brady is talking return again. And this to me is fascinating. So he was on a podcast, Deep Cuts with Vic Blends. I never heard of it until the other day. And maybe I'll listen to it more if he's going to have Tom Brady on, for sure. But he was asked if a situation presented itself, would he come back to the NFL? And he said the Patriots, could be the Raiders. He said, I'm not opposed to it. I don't know if they're going to let me if I become an owner of an NFL team. I don't know. I'm always going to be in good shape, always going to be able to throw the ball. So to come in for a little bit, like Michael Jordan coming back, I don't know if they'd let me, but I wouldn't be opposed to that. Okay. So that Jordan thing sticks out to me because Brady said all these things in his second retirement about how he's done. He's done playing football, right? It does seem like he sort of wanted to be like Michael Jordan, right? Where Julian Edelman was on the Boss Bill Simmons podcast recently, and he said that he was telling Tom that, hey, you can catch Montana. And Brady said, I'm not going for Montana. I'm going for Jordan, meaning he wanted to pass Jordan 6 rings to get a 7th ring, which, of course, he did when he went to Tampa. But I think with Brady, the only guy that kind of has a similar career to him is Michael Jordan. Like, that's the only real guy that you can compare yourself to in the world, like Tom Brady, right? Even the greatest quarterbacks of all time, none of them had the aura and consistent winning like Tom did. And so I think when you look at Tom, he says, wait, how did Jordan handle his post-career? Well, he owned a team, right? And remember, that was Tom's original idea. He was going to go to the Dolphins, and that whole thing got botched, right? Remember that. That was going to be the situation for Tom. That situation doesn't work out. He goes back to Tampa. And then he sort of last year has this year of waiting in broadcasting, right? So he's not going to do that until the 2024 season. And they're still waiting on this whole Raiders thing, right? The NFL Network has reported multiple times that it's on schedule, but eventually that's going to happen, it appears, right? And as the rules currently sit, if he's the minority owner, he can't play for the team. Now, they could change the rules if they wanted to. Like, if you're the owners and you can get 24 out of, what, the 32? I mean, that's what has to happen for a rule to pass to get Tom Brady to play. I'm sure they would do it for ratings. Like, they're like, wait, we can get Tom Brady back. But anyway, I just think when you look at Brady, this is why I bring up Jordan, because nothing else has matched his competitiveness, right? And his desire to win. Nothing, since he's retired, nothing has been on that same level to him, right? And this, to me, this isn't Tom, like, when he makes a comment like this, this isn't about trying to get attention or anything like that. I believe Tom is legit searching for something that can replace that competitive fire and competitive drive. So he's tried out all these different things, and he's going to try out broadcasting. That's going to be another experiment for him. He'll see if he's great at that. And being part of an ownership group, eventually, probably that's going to happen, it appears. But I just think he misses it. He just wants to be in the mix. And Tom, I think he thought he was done. He probably felt like his body was done. But then he's saying how he's still in shape. And I think he's never going to find that outlet besides playing football, right? When you're that sick of a competitor, it's just different. Like, other athletes can find something, right? Like, that aren't on the Brady Jordan sort of stratosphere. Like Peyton Manning, unbelievable quarterback, most MVPs in NFL history, not on the same level as Brady and Jordan. He's got the Manning cast. Like, he's found something. Barkley, biggest star on TV. Shaq has all these business ventures, and he does TV. Pedro does TV. Ortiz does TV to do some local guys here. But Brady hasn't found that thing, right? And, like, when he said it, I think he means he would come back. I really think he thinks he could come back. Because I think about it. Look at Jordan, who he brings up. Like, Jordan, he took 3 years off from the NBA. He came back. He averaged 23 a game. And then the next year at 39, he played 82 games. He played 82 games. So I think he looks at how the NFL works now, and he says, hey, quarterbacks are protected. I think he genuinely thinks he could still play at a high level. He just did a few years ago. So I think he just looks at it that way. Like, why couldn't I do this? And he's asked a question, and he's answering it honestly. Like, yeah, I think I could. I think I could still come back and play if they wanted me to. And I think the other thing I would say is this. I wonder if Pat Mahomes now being talked about as much as he is in terms of he's in the Brady conversation and Tom just left. Like, there's nothing Tom can do about it. I think that's probably something that Jordan probably got sick of. And not that Jordan came back to the NBA during this time, but Jordan probably got sick at times hearing about, oh, is LeBron better than Jordan? And Tom's probably like, well, they're saying this about Mahomes and I can still play. And everybody forgets, like, I beat Mahomes in the playoffs twice. Like, it's nobody talks about that, right? So I do really truly believe that Tom thinks he could return to the NFL. I know, like, a lot of people saw that on Twitter, Instagram, wherever you saw it on social media, or if you listen to the pod, and you're like, well, I think he's just saying this. It's like, I don't think that at all. I actually think he's dead serious. I think if he had an opportunity, he would, because I think that he realizes, like, this is it. Like, I want to do more stuff. And I think he still thinks that he can compete at a high level. And that's the only thing that he can get those competitive juices from is playing in the NFL. All right, I'll continue my Sunday thoughts coming up next. Off the Pike is presented by FanDuel. The NBA play-in tournament gives teams the chance to play their way into the postseason. So it only seems right that new customers on FanDuel can play their way into $150. Just place any $5 bet and you'll get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose, to use during the NBA playoffs. So I'm looking at the Eastern Conference. I like Philly to beat Miami. The Sixers have been playing real well since Embiid came back from the injury. He got Sunday off as well, so he should be fresh for this one. And FanDuel is now live in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Just go to FanDuel.com/pike to get started. FanDuel, official sports betting partner of the NBA. Must be 21 plus, 18 plus in D.C. and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. All right, my next Sunday thought is it's nice to see the Red Sox offense wake up on this game on Sunday. They start to hit a little bit over the weekend. Nice to see the back-to-back home runs from O'Neill and Casas in that first inning. And I told you on multiple occasions, I'm not worried about Casas because, I mean, he's hitting the crap out of the ball in April. Prior to this game today in April, 317, 391, a 977 OPS with four home runs and now five bombs after today. It was basically the one series. He had one bad series to start the season against Seattle. They threw him a bunch of sliders. He's now made the adjustment, and his numbers look a lot better. But you look at the offense in general, this Red Sox offense, they're 22nd in batting average, 22nd on base, 20th in slug, 19th in OPS, and 27th in strikeout rate. Now, some of those numbers will go up after everything finalizes after the games today. But the point being is this team hasn't really been hitting enough considering that they have other issues, like, for example, that their defense is one of the worst defenses in Major League Baseball. So with this Raffy situation that we talked about earlier, they really need Casas to be the guy that carries the lineup, and he clearly can do it. And if you think about it, along with O'Neill, who O'Neill came into the day 6th in slug, he hit his 7th home run, which is the most in Major League Baseball, but he had an 1124 OPS 5th. O'Neill's been awesome, and I think he's going to have a really good year. Like, you can see, like, this guy has a ton of power. He's on time. He looks right. He looks healthy. Like, that's been one of his biggest issues, just staying on the football field. So I have confidence that O'Neill's going to have a good season. He's just not going to be one of the best hitters in the sport. And with Casas, I do believe he can be. And it's simple if you really look at it with Casas. If you just break it down, it was a bunch of sliders, sort of figured that out. And the biggest thing is he's hitting the ball in the air. You look at in March, the launch angle was 6 degrees, which anything under 10 degrees is a ground ball. So it doesn't matter how hard you're hitting it, because when Casas gets a hold of it, everything's going to be a hard hit ball. But the problem was everything was going to the ground. This month, that number is over 10 degrees. It's at 11.1. It should be up more than that. But that 6.0 would rank around 165th among 189 hitters. Like, so that's not a good number. Even 11.1 is not a great number for Casas in terms of a launch angle. Last year, he was at 15.7 degrees, which is sort of perfect for barreling up balls with how hard he hits it, right? So that last year was 37th out of 136 qualifiers. So he has so much raw power. All he has to do is elevate the ball and he's going to do damage. Like, the power that this guy has is absolutely ridiculous right now. So it's good to see Casas pick it up from an offensive perspective, especially over the weekend. The home runs on Saturday and on Sunday. And then the other guy to look for now is Yoshida, because they really need Yoshida to get going, because we're starting to see it now, okay, where he's got a 5-game hitting streak. It's what he's hit safely in 6 of 7. And if you look at this game today, he hits the home run, which was huge. He got a sinker, middle, and hit it out of the ballpark. And it's interesting to me where I'm not delusional, because Yoshida's a DH, but he's not like an old school DH that's going to hit for a ton of power. But I do wonder, like, he's not going to, like, last year he hit 15 bombs, so he's not going to hit a ton of home runs. But when you look at his contract, the 5 years, 90 mil. So he's making, what, 18 million this season. So he has to at least hit. Like, I know that sounds simplistic. The DH needs to hit, but he's not going to slug like crazy. He needs to get on base consistently. And one of the things we've been seeing is, so far this season, and he did, as I mentioned, the sinker, the two-seamer hit out of the ballpark today, he'd been struggling hitting fastballs. Like, he'd been seeing 53.1% fastballs, and he was only hitting 226. Last season, he had 315 against Heater. So that's the first thing. It's just he's had issues with fastballs. So one of the things that he was doing, and I do wonder if you think about it, the at-bat before the home run, he hit it to left center, and it almost went out. It landed right on the warning, or it almost went off the wall, landing on the warning track there. I felt that was a good sign, because he hadn't been going the opposite way at all. And that's one thing where if you go back to last season, he was going the opposite way 28.4% of the time. Prior to this game today, that number was at 13.6%, and he was pulling it 43.2% of the time. So if you think about those numbers, 13.6% in terms of going the opposite way, entering this game today, that was 174th out of 189 qualifiers, a little metric man breakdown here. Last year, that number was at 28.3%, as we said, that was 18th. So he has not been the same hitter in terms of how he's going about his at-bats. He's not going the other way at all. So I don't know if it's just, hey, he's not, the timing's not right, or maybe it's, hey, he's kind of trying to live up to the DH role a little bit too much, right? He's getting a little pull happy. He's trying to hit everything out of the ballpark. But it's very encouraging to see him go the opposite way, because Yoshida last season, he had 55 hits the opposite way, the eighth most in Major League Baseball, only had one entering today, and he hit 426 the opposite way. That was 13th. So that's been a big part of his game, going the opposite way, just going where the pitch takes him, that he hasn't really, we haven't seen much of this year. So hopefully he'll start to do that and we'll see these numbers go up. And last year, right around this time, Dave O'Brien actually said it on the NESN broadcast, is when he started to get hot. So maybe we'll see that again going forward here. Okay. Another Sunday thought. There was a report that Brandon Ayuk demanded a trade. His agent then replied on Twitter, "You need better sources to the report." But anyway, there still appears to be a lot to be figured out there in San Francisco with Ayuk and his future with that San Francisco 49ers team. But let's, for the sake of the pod, assume that Brandon Ayuk is on the market. Should the Patriots trade for him? So if you look at the trade structure, it'd probably be similar to A.J. Brown, which is a first and a third, because it's sort of the same time of the contract where the guy's about to be on the fifth-year option. You're going to have to eventually extend him. So we know the Patriots were obviously interested in Calvin Ridley. They thought they were going to get him. Let's compare the players. Ayuk last year, 70.5 yards per game. Ridley, 59.8. Ayuk, 17.9 yards per reception, third among receivers. Ridley, 13.4, 42nd among receivers. And here's the other thing. Ayuk is entering his prime, his 26-year-old season. Ridley is entering his 30-year-old season. Not to say that Ridley's old, but Ayuk, you got a longer runway here in terms of elite play. Ayuk is still getting better as a player. Ridley's not, right? Ayuk just had his best season. Ridley has had much better seasons than the one that he had last year in Jacksonville. So everything tells you, you should do this. If he's available, you should be in the market. And that doesn't mean you're the team that automatically lands him. But if the Niners decide, hey, before the draft, we're going to put Ayuk on the table, the Patriots should be calling the San Francisco 49ers and try to get a deal done, right? Because if you look at it, the Patriots are going to take their franchise quarterback, as we know, with the third pick. So, or at least they believe the guy's going to be the franchise quarterback. The point is they're going to take a quarterback with number three, right? So we know the Patriots need a left tackle, and we know they need a number one receiver still. They thought they were going to solve that with Calvin Ridley, even though I didn't think Ridley was a number one receiver. They thought Ridley could take care of that problem for them, right? But what are the odds that the Patriots get a franchise left tackle and B, a number one wide receiver in the draft this year? The odds are very long, right? And what we saw from the Patriots in the offseason already with the Ridley situation going after Calvin Ridley, they wanted to take care of the number one option thing in free agency, right? And that's not even debatable. They legit tried to do it. They offered him a contract, right? So they were almost forcing the issue because they were so desperate at the position. They were talking themselves in to Ridley being a number one option when he's really not a number one. Brandon Ayuk is a number one receiver. And I know you could say, well, Brian, that's giving up a lot for a team that is rebuilding. You want to give up a future first and a future second because, or a future third, because obviously you're not giving up the third pick this year. You would give up your 2025, your 2026. You would not be giving up this year's pick. But we're talking about a player that is just entering his prime. And when I look at this too, it's not just an investment in the receiver. It's an investment in your quarterback. We've seen what happens when you don't give the quarterbacks the necessary weapons, right? And this isn't making excuses for a guy like Mac Jones, but you need to give your young players elite weapons around them. Look at what Tyreek Hill and Waddle did for Tua. Heck, look at what Ayuk and look at what Debo and look at what Kittle do for Brock Purdy. This is how the NFL works nowadays. You have to make life as easy as you possibly can for your quarterback because it's very difficult to play quarterback at the NFL. That's not rocket science, right? But I don't understand, like, if this guy's there, if he's on the market, the Patriots should do all they can because he's not, it's not like he's 32. It's not like he's 33. This isn't like a DeAndre Hopkins situation from last off. See, this guy is legitimately entering his prime. And if the Niners are stupid enough to give up on him, you have to be all over that if you're Elliott Wolf and company, because we know you realize you need top-tier weapons because you don't have them. You thought Calvin Ridley was one. Now you have a better option. I don't care about giving up the first, because what were you going to use the first on next year? Let's say the hypothetical is you get Drake May. you draft a receiver, but he's not a number one. You draft, say your left tackle works out or you have a good receiver, you're still going to draft another receiver or you're still going to be after receivers in free agency. Just take care of this problem when you can. All right, so those are my Sunday thoughts. Coming up next, we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. Joining us now, it is producer extraordinaire, Jamie McClellan. Jamie, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm great, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. I'm doing well. No complaints. Nice little Sunday. You know what I watched last night?
Tell me.
I was up until 2 a.m. I kid you not, I watched the UFC card.
One of my brothers, it was in Vegas, right?
Yeah. One of my brothers asked me, hey, do you want to watch the UFC? I said, let's do it. I was not disappointed at all. I'm not the biggest UFC guy. Like, I'll watch the big cards, but a lot of times when they're going on until 2 a.m., I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do it. But it was UFC 300. It was a massive event. So I'm like, okay, let's do this thing. And I kid you not, one of the best fights I've ever seen. Max Holloway versus Justin Gaethje. One of the most epic knockouts you will ever see. So these guys are going at it for five rounds. It's not even a real belt. The belt they call it is like the BMF belt. I think it stands for baddest motherfucker. Like that's what the belt's called.
I want that one.
It can switch divisions too. It's not even like a real like weight class belt, right? It's just a BMF belt, right? So you got Holloway and Gaethje going on. So Holloway in the first round gets him in the nose. He definitely broke his nose in the first round, bleeding out of both sides of his nose. Like Gaethje's in massive trouble, but he's gonna make it the distance. Like they're going for five rounds. A lot of it's like they're on their feet most of it, so they're going back and forth. Holloway's just throwing haymakers at the guy. So finally at the end, there's like 10 seconds left in the fight. He starts pointing to the middle of the octagon and he tells Gaethje, I give the Gaethje guy a ton of credit. I've seen him fight a couple of other times, but I give him credit. Like this guy is beat up like crazy. He starts pointing to the middle of the ring, like come in the middle of the ring and start throwing with me. Holloway knocks him out cold with 1 second left.
Wow.
1 second left in the fight. 1 second left. He gets him with a knockout. And he just starts going nuts. He's climbing up the octagon. It was absolutely insane.
That's exciting. Would he have won anyways, Brian, you think, in the decision?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
By a landslide?
He won every round. He would have won. But he wanted to do it because
that's cool.
I think it was $600,000 for best finish or best, I think, or the combination. Because he said right after the fight, he's like, write the check for $600,000 to Dana White. He said, guy's absolutely hilarious, man. He was going absolutely nuts. There was another fight earlier in the night where one of the dudes, he like punched a guy in the stands. I'm like, what is going on?
<That's crazy. laughs>
His entrance to the ring. Yeah, and then the last fight was just, man, guy's an absolute beast, the light heavyweight champion. But yeah, it was a fun night. It was a lot of fun watching UFC because it was a good day because you had the Masters going on all day Saturday. Mm-hmm. And then you had the UFC after that. You had the Red Sox in the middle of the day. You had the Bees and the Pens at... That was an 8 o'clock game. Sean McDonough calling that on ABC. So that was a fun day. So yeah, I basically did nothing all day. I sat down and watched sports and fighting.
Not bad. I'm a night owl as well, so I appreciate those. I think UFC, that's got to be like the latest televised like North American sport, I feel like. What time did that start for you? Like that last fight?
The last fight started...
Like 1?
Yeah, around. I think it was like right around 1.
That's because even in Vegas, that's a 10 p.m. start. That's crazy.
Yeah, like the prelims, I think there was like more. I don't know if this for a fact. I'm not the biggest UFC guy, but the prelims started super early. And there was a lot of good fights on the prelims, too. Obviously, I didn't know who most of them were. But yeah, they all started. I mean, I think that at one point. Yeah, because the second to last fight went the distance and the one before it basically went the distance. He's going to be able to knock out one with 1 second left.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the only thing I didn't like about it is like they're like announcing their and maybe this is me just like nitpicking. They're like announcing throughout the night like their Hall of Fame class. I'm like, there's already a Hall of Fame. Like, how many?
Packed like in, yeah.
Chael Sonnen made it, and they did do this like cool thing, like this tribute back to when he fought Anderson Silva back in the day, and he was beating him up for like 4.5 rounds, and then Silva ended up getting a submission to win it. But they're like, they're talking about like the Hall of Fame inductees. I'm like, okay, I don't think we really need to do this. Like,
no,
I don't know.
He's a little premature. Have you ever been to a fight or a boxing match?
I've been to boxing. I've never been to a UFC. I gotta go. It just seems like a crazy atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually on Radio Row for the first Wilder Fury.
Oh, cool. That would have been fun.
Yeah, that was in LA.
Oh yeah? Where? The Staples Center or what?
I didn't actually go to the fight. I was just at the Radio Row during the week.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I was there Wednesday through Friday and left on Friday. The fight, yeah, I'm pretty sure though the fight was at the Staples Center.
Mm-hmm. I think he's fighting this summer, right, Fury?
Probably, yeah. He's still the number one heavyweight in the world. I think Wilder's dropped back. But dude, Wilder came in and I could not believe how big that guy was. He was absolutely
They're
massive.
Both huge. Fury
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Fury's huge too. Yeah,
yeah, the biggest.
Wilder is like, I mean, Fury's. They're obviously both massive, but Wilder is like absolutely jacked out of his mind.
I'm ready for that. I somehow, because Twitter is crazy, I was watching some videos of Jake Paul getting ready to fight Mike Tyson this summer. But Tyson looked like he was looking pretty good. Probably a little
slow.
Dude,
the punches he's throwing, I'm like, dude, I don't want to get punched by Mike. I mean, I never would want to get punched. It looks scary. I love when he makes the cameo in The Hangover and he just
punches what, Zach Galifianakis? That was the first time I ever laid eyes on Zach Galifianakis. He was like the best debut of all time.
Yeah, the guy's hilarious.
Brian, you think though, first and a third though for Ayuk?
Yeah, I'd do
price,
it,
man.
You wouldn't do it for a number one receiver?
I'm scared that he's like, you know, he's hanging out with George Kittle and Deebo Samuel and McCaffrey. They're all getting attention on the field with him. I don't know. I felt like AJ Brown did more within the Titans.
Yeah, that's a good point, but I think that he's the best out of that trio. McCaffrey's their best offensive player, but out of the Deebo
receivers.
Yeah, now at this point. And by the way, Debo's like misses half the games, or at least he comes. And same thing, like he's always hurt. He's always dealing with something. I just think Ayuk's the better pure receiver. And if you don't get a receiver, like at the top of the second round, next free agency, you're looking for it again. Next draft, you're looking for it again. Like if I can have week one, well, it probably won't happen in week one, but let's say week eight, I'm bringing out Drake May. And he's like, I'm throwing the ball to Brandon Ayuk. That's going to look a lot better than, hey, I'm throwing it just to Mario Douglas and Kendrick Bourne. And I like both those guys a lot. You know what I mean? But if you have Brandon Ayuk and then you have Douglas and then you have Kendrick Bourne, it's like, whoa, this thing kind of makes sense now.
No, totally in terms of helping the quarterback. I wonder though, like on the human side, if these guys' egos, like Elliot Wolf and Jon Mayo, like they want these picks. They want to prove that they can get the next Brandon Ayuk. You know what I mean?
Maybe. Although they were trying to get Ridley.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to give up a first round pick for that.
True. But I take like Ayuk's already
someone.
Yeah, Ayuk's already a significantly better player than Ridley, and he's younger, 4 years younger.
What about if you could go Higgins or Ayuk? Higgins probably a little cheaper, right?
I'd probably be similar, but I like Ayuk more than Higgins because he's more of a burner. Mm-hmm. I like Higgins. He's a contested catch guy, but I think that Ayuk is going to be a number one wherever he goes. I'm not so sure. Like, I think Higgins is probably a 1.5. You know what I mean? Like, if he's tasked to be the number one guy, I'm not sure he is. I believe Ayuk is.
It's going to be fun, Brian. Something's going to happen, right, between now and draft day. So it should be good.
I hope so, man.
Yeah.
All right, Jamie. Good stuff, man.
Thank you, Brian.
As always, make sure to get your voicemails in, 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Strudy for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.